Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
When moldy oldies get a sonic cleansing. Welcome to Soundcheck. I'm Joel Meyer, a producer on the show, sitting in for John Schaefer. Ahead today, we explore the booming business of reissues. Plus, composer and percussionist Lucas Ligeti and Burkina Electric share his brand of African grooves. Now, call us cynical here at Soundcheck, but every day there's another press release touting one album reissue or another. Sometimes they're unusual, like this obscure 70s gem by the Detroit trombonist and conga player Melvin Price. And quite often, they're very familiar. In the next few months, the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, Miles Davis, and other acts will get the reissue treatment. Today, in the third and final part of our Friday series on nostalgia in music, we'll ask if reissues have value. Joining us is Amir Abdullah, the label manager at Wax Poetics, which specializes in lost funk, soul, and R&B albums, and Alan Kozin, music critic at the New York Times and our resident Beatles authority. Alan, we'll start with you. One of the biggest reissues ever, I believe the precise number of copies it has sold is 1 bajillion, is the Eagles' Greatest Hits, one of the best-selling CDs of all time. Why are reissues so popular with consumers?
I think that, first of all, I object to thinking of it as nostalgia. It depends what it is. I think for a lot of people, the music that they either grew up with or got to like at some point in their lives when they began listening seriously to music is important to them, and they want a CD or an LP, if they're returning to LPs, that sounds as close as possible to the master tape. And the whole point of CD reissues and a lot of these, you know, other high-tech reissues is that the companies are returning to the master tapes, taking care with the transfers, and giving you something that perhaps is a bit closer to what the artists heard in the studio than what you had before. I mean, sometimes they're lying, and it's not. It kind of remains to be seen, you know, as each issue comes out, whether it really is a big improvement. And,
okay, so it might sometimes it is nostalgia. Sometimes it's sort of correcting the artist's original intent. How often is it just sort of a money making venture, a way to get more money out of a back catalog that a label has?
It probably is a good deal of the time. I mean, sometimes both of those reasons coincide. The Rolling Stones, for instance, are reissuing their catalog again, their post-1971 catalog. And I'm not sure really what the reasons are, but the fact is the Rolling Stones control that part of the catalog themselves, and they keep changing labels for distribution of their sort of Rolling Stones logo. And each time they change the label, we get a new bunch of reissues of those things. Now, whether they have actually gone back each time to the masters and made new CD masters, I'm not really sure. And whether the new ones are going to be, you know, remastered from scratch, I'm not sure. But for fanatical collectors, we'll get them anyway, and we'll make their comparisons. And, sometimes a reissue comes out, and if you read the internet chat among people who are very serious about it, they'll say, no, this new one is no good. The highs are taken off because they're trying to get rid of too much hiss or whatever, and the previous issue is better, or the Japanese issue is better.
So that can be the case with very, very familiar artists. Let's go over to Amir Abdullah. Amir, you work for Wax Poetics, a label that releases albums that many times nobody has heard or very few people have heard besides the people that are putting a compilation or a reissue of an album out. Why do you think that those albums are so popular? What are people looking for when they buy one of those CDs?
Well, in my opinion, I think a lot of people are looking for something fresh and new. Besides, you know, you just explained that the Beatles and a few other people have rehashed their catalog. So it's not that special anymore. So people are looking for something, you know, and especially with, you know, great stories. behind the record.
That's
know?
And sometimes
that's really important
on CDs from Wax Poetics or from some of the other labels that do similar things to what you do. It is you are kind of mining a storyline, right?
Yes, I like to be able to reissue a record, or I'd rather say re-release a record, as it should have been, with a story. I don't want to just put out a record and there's no story to gravitate towards as a consumer, because that consumer, the younger consumer, is really getting into the whole package of the record, of the person. You know, they want to know why the person played, you know, a B3, and you know, or whatever instrument.
Alan, we know a lot about the Beatles' story. What makes a reissue of the Beatles, which, you know, the ones that are on deck for September 9th, 9909, they're coming out. What makes those special? We're real familiar with that story.
Well, it will remain to be seen on September 9th. The idea is that the CDs that were released in 1987 now don't sound so great. It seems likely that they weren't transferred in the best way. I mean, technology has changed a bit. High-resolution transferring formats have now come in, and most other groups from that era have had their stuff redone, and actually, in many cases, it does sound better. Plus, the packaging was awful on the original CDs.
And so, even with all of the stuff that's happened with the Beatles, the movies in the last couple of years, the anthology that came out in the 90s, we still really those are the original versions of, or the original conversions, I should say, of those albums from 87.
Right. And if you were to compare some of the recent releases that EMI has put out of the Beatles, even though they're not exactly the same stuff, but the Love album or some of the anthologies, you can hear that the sound is a lot better than on the original CDs. And so the feeling among collectors has been, why can't we have the basic catalog in the best possible sound? This is just the basic catalog. There's no extras here. There are no unreleased things. And in fact, they're putting out two boxed sets. One is the stereo issues and one is the mono issues. And in fact, really both of those mixes fit on one CD. So there is a bit of sort of double dipping that EMI is doing. But you know, a lot of the mono mixes had never been out on CD before, and they're actually audibly different than the stereo mixes. You get sort of different vocal takes sometimes, different instrumental lines happening. And most people actually haven't heard the mono mixes since the 60s.
And, well, like any Beatles project, the reissues that are set for this September, there's the details on them are the lid has been closed fairly tightly. But we're going to do sort of a before and after comparison of what kind of improvements people might hear on that. Can you help set this up with Nowhere Man?
Well, actually, the two versions of Nowhere Man we're going to listen to are not actually what they're going to hear, because what they're using is the original 1960s mixes. Now, the first version of Nowhere Man we have is the 1965 mix that was heard on Rubber Soul, and it uses a style of stereo that that George Martin was working on with at the time, based on the limitations of mixing technology at the time. I mean, he actually did better mixes than this, but this is a fairly egregious one, where the vocals are all on one side and the instruments are all on the other side. The 1999 mix, which is the other one we're going to hear, comes from a record called the Yellow Submarine Song Track, which the Beatles put out, or Apple and EMI put out, when the Yellow Submarine film was reissued. And they went back to the master tapes, which is not what they're doing this time. They went back to the master tapes and completely remixed it. So what you hear at the beginning of Nowhere Man is the vocals spread right across the mix, and it's actually a much better mix.
Let's take a listen. This is Nowhere Man, the original 1965 mix from Rubber Soul.
He's a real nowhere man, sitting in his nowhere land, making all his nowhere plans. Listen, you don't know what you're
So that's the original 1965 mix of Nowhere Man from Rubber Soul. Here's the difference that Alan Kozin is talking about from 1999, the Yellow Submarine song track version of Nowhere Man. Nowhere Man from the 1999 Yellow Submarine song track. That's a remastered version of Nowhere Man. We heard the difference before and after. I'm here with Alan Kozin, classical music critic of the New York Times. Also here is Amir Abdullah, the label manager for Wax Poetics. Amir, I wanted to ask you, we're listening to kind of a difference of how one song can be reshaped by remastering. When you take a nugget that you found, how much cleaning up happens when you decide to release an album?
A lot.
A lot?
Yes, a lot. Because, you know, some of the records that we reissue, they were not put out by EMI, so they didn't have the staff and the equipment and the money to really warehouse these masters correctly. Some of these masters have been in attics, basements, not temperature controlled, and have other boxes on them. So you really have to go in there and dig deep and really have to have a person that has a great ear and that knows analog sound so he or she can, you know, transfer it to digital format. So it takes a lot of work, and it also takes a lot of money.
And how long does it take, do you think, from start to finish? When Wax Poetics decides they have something that they think is really special, mm-hmm. they want to put it out, how long from the start of finding that nugget to actually putting it on a record store shelf?
That could be 4 or 5 months.
Okay.
It is a really a long process, and you also have to roll out, you know, the promotions and marketing for the record as well.
And how do you find them? I mean, that's, I don't know if that's a trade secret, but...
No, it's not a trade secret. I mean, the way I find them, like I was explaining to Alan before, that everyone at Wax Poetics pretty much is a record collector. So we have all had our dream records that we want to reissue. And the Lyman record was one of mine. I've had the original for 15 years, and I really wanted to meet him and reissue this record. And it took me a long time, but I found him. I went to Detroit. I took him to dinner. Yes.
And that was helpful, I assume.
Yes, it was very helpful. You know, he loved his Jameson. He's God rest the dead. God bless the dead. He passed away a month ago. And he was really excited that someone my age came to him and said, I love your music. Because for him, it was made and it was gone.
Let's take a listen. This is the song Saturday Night Special. This is from that artist that Amir is talking about, Lyman Woodard, here on Soundcheck. Saturday Night Special, the title track from the Lyman Woodard release that came out on Wax Poetics. Amir Abdullah is the label manager for Wax Poetics. He's here with me. Also is Alan Kozin, the classical music critic. And Soundcheck listeners, we want to hear what you think. Will you buy the Beatles reissues that are coming out, or do you buy soul and R&B reissues that from artists like Lyman Woodard that you've never heard of? We want to hear from you. You can give us a call, 212-433-WNYC. You can also leave a comment on the Soundcheck page at wnyc.org. That phone number again, 212-433-9696. 92. One comment coming in on the Soundcheck page. Carlos from New Jersey asks, I thought the only real reason for a reissue was for the artist and production house to keep the rights to the music. Can you explain the role of reissuing in copywriting? So, Amir, I'm going to toss this to you first. Okay. What kind of process do you have to go through when you find a Lyman Woodard album and it's that old? How right. difficult is it to get the rights to it?
Well, you have to do a lot of research. I have to find, you know, a lot of artists say they own the rights to their record. You can't take their word because it could be the label that actually still owns the record. So it takes a lot of research. You know, you really have to find who owns the publishing rights besides the mechanical rights. You know, everything has to be included. You have to do your due diligence in that aspect. And, you know, some of the musicians that played on the record, you know, they may come out of the woodworks like, you know, hey, I didn't get paid for this. So you have to cover all your bases. With Lyman, it was a bit easier because the label went out of the business. The original label was Strata Records from Detroit. So, you know, kind of a well-known label in the Detroit area. The owner gave him the masters and had a written letter saying, I give these to you.
I see.
You can do whatever you want. So in court, we were, you know, if we, it ever came to that, we could use that. So that made it a bit easier. Lyman owned his own publishing as well.
Alan, over to you. When artists, maybe the Beatles, maybe other artists, how important is a reissue to not just making a quick buck, but also to keeping ownership in their court?
I think what the writer is referring to is the fact that copyright has a certain term and that the term extends from the time of publication. So, you know, in classical music, for instance, you would have Stravinsky writing a piece in 1908 and then revising it in some very minor way and republishing it in 1947 so that the clock starts ticking again. I'm not sure how that applies to recordings. It's a kind of a different copyright world. But what Amir says, I mean, I've seen that happen in classical music too, where someone wanted to put out a really interesting London Symphony Orchestra, Charles McCarris, I think, recording of some Tchaikovsky things, and they were made in the 60s, and they had to find every single member of the orchestra and work out the payments with them before that reissue could come out, because it actually wasn't a reissue. It was an archival tape that had never been reissued. So they had to kind of make really a new contract. And yeah.
Well, we're going to get into classical music reissues when we come back from the break. We're also going to hear from some of our Soundcheck listeners as well, too. Our discussion of reissues continues with Alan Kozin of the New York Times and Amir Abdullah from Wax Poetics. We're going to go to break here with Patrizia and Jimmy. This is called Trust Your Child, and it's from a compilation called The ABCs of Kid Soul. And that's exactly what it is. It was released by the Chicago-based label Numero Group. You're listening to Soundcheck.
In the first place, if my mother and father can't trust each other, count your mile, then what the heck do you think is going to happen to me? I'm their child. You see, the reason we use a generation gap as an excuse is because instead of trusting us, you use abuse. I'd like to remind you that you were a child once upon a time. And if your parents treated you like some of you treat us, then neither were they so kind.
Our discussion of reissues continues in your calls. And then coming up later, Lugas Ligeti performs live with Burkina Electric, an ensemble that fuses West African grooves and electronic dance sounds. That's later on Soundcheck. Ready or not, the Rolling Stones are on the reissue bandwagon. This is Soundcheck. I'm producer Joel Meyer in today for John Schaefer. Today, in the third and final part of our Friday series on nostalgia in music, we're looking at the value of reissues. Joining us is Amir Abdullah, the label manager at Wax Poetics, which specializes in lost funk, soul, and R&B albums, and Alan Kozin, music critic at the New York Times and our resident Beatles authority. And we want to hear from you today as well. What do you think of reissues? Are you a compulsive buyer? Do you love crate digging and finding old stuff? Or are you looking forward to hearing new versions of Beatles music that you might already be familiar with? You can give us a call at 212-433-WNYC. You can leave a comment on the soundcheck page as well at WNYC.org. Jack from Brooklyn posted a comment. He's a little skeptical. He says, so basically what's being said is this. We rushed this material to market and know it, and consumers paid for it. Now we fixed the problems, so what you bought before is essentially obsolete. Sounds like a form of built-in obsolescence that the CD industry has come up with to milk the consumer both ways. Alan, what do you think?
I think he's actually right. You know, when CD first came out, they promised the advertising line was perfect sound forever. This was around 1984. I did a piece maybe in 1986 or 87 for the Times that took a whole lot of things that had been rushed out initially on CD and were now out in even better new sound because they finally had gone back to the actual master tapes instead of a third generation LP submaster. And I sort of had, you know, wondered in this piece about, well, you know, is this a consumer ripoff? Because after all, when CDs came out, they were even more expensive than they are now. And so I called someone at CBS, which is now Sony, and he said, well, you know, we don't really feel we're ripping anybody off because the people who bought them initially are the people who had to be the first people on their block to have CDs. And I thought, well, wait a minute, these are the people who have given you an industry, you know? And it did seem awfully cynical. So I think your correspondent is correct there. That said, I mean, also in the distance between 1987 and now, in the early 1980s and now, I mean, technology has improved.
Right.
So, you know, really in a lot of cases, people are looking forward to a better sounding disc now than they could have gotten in 1987. And for a lot of people who collect reissues, they're also looking for bonus tracks, some outtakes, other things. They're not going to get them on the Beatles things, but they get them on a lot of other people's.
But the bottom line is now that the CD is nearly extinct, they've just got it right. It seems like they're just getting the hang of this thing. And
yeah.
let's hear from one more listener. Joe joins us from New Jersey. Joe, are you a fan of reissues?
I am not actually.
No.
I'm calling out from the younger generation. My viewpoint is really going to be representing the 25 and below category. And my point that I wanted to make was I really love the music that Mr. Abdul had played, the music that I had never heard of before. Because when I go to visit my parents anytime, that music, the older music is on, the music that I can find, the music that would be remastered. I mean, that my point being, that's everywhere. But I think my generation is one that really idolizes nostalgic music, and we're looking for that stuff we haven't heard of yet. We're looking for what we can make into new kitsch. And I think that, you know, I'll certainly be hunting down that album that I just heard, and I think it's a perfect example right there. I'd rather see that than the remastered Beatles, Rolling Stones, Jimi Hendrix stuff that, I mean, I can... I feel horrible saying this, but it's a click away for us.
All right. Okay, well, Joe...
I like to find the stuff that I've never heard before.
And, all right. Joe makes an interesting point, and he also coins an interesting term that I think that we should use, which is new kitsch. Amir, I'm looking at you. Does Wax Poetics, is that kind of your bread and butter? Is new kitsch what Joe's talking about?
Yes, definitely. And by the way, thank you very much, Joe. I want to say that. Yes, I mean, that's the purpose of the label. That's the purpose of the magazine. We're doing rediscoveries for a lot of people.
Wax Poetics is a magazine, we should add. It's
yes.
been a magazine for about 9 years, yes. and then the label was hatched about 2 years ago.
Right, exactly. And touching on some of the things that Alan was talking about, like specifically with the Lyman record, you know, we added a few things. We added, 180-gram vinyl. We made it on double vinyl.
Holding a copy right now.
Yes.
As we speak, you're holding
yes.
it.
And, you know, we added the original poster that came with the record. You know, there's a lot, and there's an extra track on it. You know, these are what consumers are looking for, besides just unknown music, little tidbits like that go along with it as well, you know. You know, that's really the main purpose of the label.
Alan, can major artists like the Beatles, like the Rolling Stones or Miles Davis, you know, in jazz, reissues are, that's the bread and butter of that genre in terms of retail sales. Can those reissues still generate that same kind of story and that new kitsch, if it were?
Well, you know, I don't know about the kitsch thing. Uh-huh. I mean, I think of kitsch as junk. I can't see why. I mean, isn't that what kitsch means, basically?
It could be.
I believe that's the dictionary.
But if you're to ask Joe from New Jersey, he doesn't think that's junk at all.
Okay, but he should look it up, perhaps. Or maybe it's taken on a new meaning. But, okay, in terms of, you know, Miles Davis, I mean, you want to talk about a story. When Miles Davis Kind of Blue was originally issued, it was pretty much a straight copy. And then a few years later, they came up with they realized that all of Psy 2 of Kind of Blue had been mastered for LP on the wrong speed. You know, just a few percentage too fast or too slow, and the CD also, you know, used that master. And so they were able to put out Kind of Blue pretty much as it was played in the studio at the right speed and with some bonus tracks and things. So there is a story a lot of the time. And when people put out extended liner notes, as the Beatles will be doing and as Amir's label does, you know, people, even people who know the original records, will be able to sort of learn something new about how the records were made or whatever, if the right research has been done.
Exactly.
We have just about 30 seconds. Amir, I need to ask you real quickly. Mm-hmm. There's a great story behind a disc that came out on Wax Poetics called East of Underground. And this has something to do with almost a talent show and entertaining troops. We just have a few seconds, but can you explain the story behind the CD?
Okay, real quick. It was a group of guys in Frankfurt, Germany, based, you know, in the Army. And there was a contest, you know, for troop morale. And this group, East of Underground, made up of a bunch of different guys, came. They had a contest. They came in second place, and they were offered this record deal. Now, to this day, we still don't know how many actual copies were made. We got the rights from the U.S. Army to do this record. They didn't have a master. They just had the vinyl. We had the master from the vinyl, and it's a great, great story. These guys, you know, really never played any other groups, just in that, you know. It's our first record, and by the way, we do everything on vinyl. As well, too. I just want to make that clear. Very little CDs.
You dare to do it, as it were. Well,
yes.
To both of you, I want to thank you so much. Alan Kozin from the New York Times, thanks for being here. And Amir Abdullah, thanks so much to both of you,
thank you.
For being on
thank
Soundcheck. East of Underground, that's the compilation that Amir Abdullah of Wax Poetics was telling us about. Smiling Faces Sometimes is the name of the track. The discussion continues on the Soundcheck page at WNYC.org. Still to come, Lucas Ligeti brings the music of West Africa into the dance club with his project Burkina Electric. That's next. And on Monday, Jazz Fest begins next week in New Orleans. We'll find out if music from that city risks being forgotten almost 4 years since Hurricane Katrina. This is Soundcheck.